El lector. Abel, his tan skin glistening, picked up the splintered plants and tossed them on the horse-drawn wagon backed up to the factory loading dock. He had stayed home from school that day to help his uncle Julian pick up the pieces of a lector's platform that had been destroyed by thugs hired by the cigar factory owners. Abel's muscled body easily loaded most of the lumber. Beside him, Julian worked slowly and silently, caressing each board as if it were an old friend, a chapter from one of his novels. Every day for the past 20 years, Julian stood on that raised platform in the middle of the factory floor, reading to the workers Ana Karenina, War and Peace, Les Miserables, writings of Cervantes, newspapers, and the poems of José Martí. He didn't just read the words. He took on the voice and the mannerisms of the characters in the novels, like an actor in the theater. Good performances were followed by sustained thumping roar of 200 chavetas, or tobacco knives, repeatedly striking the workers' cutting boards.
That was Emilio González Yanez reading from his book, Cigar City Stories, Tales of Old Ybor City. Stories reflecting life in a community of cigar makers from Cuba, Spain, and Italy, all part of the industry that made Tampa, Florida, the cigar capital of the world. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Emilio González Yanez talks with Rosemary Manchester in just a minute. Later in the broadcast, Judith Newton joins us to talk about her memoir with recipes, Tasting Home, Coming of Age in the Kitchen. Stay with us. It's A Novel Idea. Emilio González Yanez was born and raised in Ybor City, Tampa, Florida. He began writing fiction and poetry at age 60. In 1995, he produced a four-part PBS series, Qui-Gon for Health. His stories and his poetry have appeared in various publications, and here he is in conversation with Rosemary Manchester about his most recent publication, Cigar City Stories, Tales of Old Ybor City.
I love stories, and what strikes me about your stories is the wonderful nostalgia, the sadness for what is no more, and your ability to convey that emotion in a way that kept me reading and I think will keep other people reading when they get their hands on this book. Tell us, first of all, where can they find the book? Is it in the store?
Yes, you can pick up a book at Copperfields Books here in Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's also available on all the online bookstores like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at the publishers, iUniverse also.
Excellent.
And if you want an e-book, you can get it from Google for $3.
What a world we live in.
I know.
What a world. I was thinking about the... I think of the lector, the reader, and this wonderful custom of all the workers sitting there rolling cigars, which must have been a fairly boring, well, somewhat challenging work, but to sit there listening to great literature. I mean, he wasn't reading detective stories or anything contemporary. He was reading the classics to them.
Yes, and you know, the interesting thing is that the workers selected the novel that's to be read.
Oh, my goodness. You
know, and the workers hired the lector.
Yes.
He worked for the workers.
Yes.
He didn't work for the management.
Yes.
You know, in fact, the management would rather not have him around, you know, but because, you know, these Russian novels, like they said, put some crazy ideas in the workers' heads, you know.
About that's why.
Labor and workers'
yes.
rights and
yes.
so forth, you
yes.
know. So eventually the lectors were kicked out of the factories,
yes.
you know. And
yes.
It happened once before, and the workers went on strike
mm-hmm.
because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they let the lectors back in.
Mm-hmm.
But 10 years later, they got rid of them altogether in the
mm-hmm.
1930s,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, it was a wonderful time because my uncle was a lector.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle was a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things he did.
Yes.
You know, and the lector's job was a very prestigious position. They usually made more money than the cigar makers because they worked for tips. On payday, you know, the workers would put 25 cents in the hat for him, and he did very well, and the lectors usually dressed very well, and they were like actors, you know, and they were like celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
People knew them, mm-hmm. yes.
One of the things I noticed in the story, the owners of the cigar factory were from Spain.
That's
in
correct.
In other words, they were not... they were not locally owned, the factory. And so they could determine the conditions under which the workers did their work.
Yeah, they were entrepreneurs, you know,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes, you know, they paired up with businessmen from New
mm-hmm.
York. And
mm-hmm.
But really, the Spanish owners,
mm-hmm.
they made all the decisions,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Yeah. And Ybor City isn't even on the map anymore. I looked in my atlas. I found Tampa, but Ybor City wasn't even in the index.
No. Well, you know.
It's gone.
Well, it was annexed by the city of
yeah.
Tampa
mm-hmm.
In 1904, mm-hmm. all right?
Mm-hmm.
But Ybor City has always been an entity of its own. You know, it's always
yes.
had its own personality.
Yes.
It provides a place for entertainment today.
Oh.
Today, it is a tourist destination, and they've rebuilt the streetcar line. Runs between Tampa and Ybor City. They have, you know, shops and galleries and restaurants. And, you know, it's just a tourist place, really.
I see.
A tourist place today.
Yeah. I read that when the factories were no longer, when the highway came through, they bulldozed the homes in
that's
Ybor.
Right.
You know, I'd only heard of that happening in South Africa, and I thought how outrageous to bulldoze people's homes. But that happened here in America. That is a shameful thing that we did.
It is, you know, and it really is sad, you know, and it really pains my heart when
yes.
I think about what happened there. Because, you know, the factories were on the way out because they had automated,
mm-hmm.
laid off a lot of workers.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people had moved out of Ybor City.
Mm-hmm.
But then they put an interstate highway right mm-hmm. down the middle of the community. And to do that, they bulldozed many, many houses. I remember, you know, walking down Ybor City on those beautiful red brick streets and all those fruit trees in the backyard and a big black X on the door marking the houses that had to go. It was very sad. It was a very sad period, you know. And someone commented to me that afterwards it looked like Hiroshima. That's what it looked like.
The destruction of the fruit trees is a detail that always just grabs me. I remember the story of Kit Carson in the West when he was driving the Indians out, and they chopped down the peach orchard.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the, you know, there's a detail in every story that grabs your heart. You empathize with the people, but then something about those fruit trees,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that are gone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We aren't very good about preserving our history in this country. And we're certainly not very friendly to people who come to our country from other places.
Well, you know, the buildings that survived the destruction were the commercial buildings on the main street, which is 7th Avenue, and the social clubs. Each immigrant community there had built a beautiful social clubs. They're still there. They're usually four or five stories high, had ballrooms, movie theaters in them, and dance halls, and cantina on the basement, where all the immigrant Cuban and Spanish men play dominoes and drink cognac all day. But those buildings survived. And they're still there, and they're very much a tourist attraction. Some of the cigar factories have been made into shopping malls like Ghirardelli Square or something like that. Yeah. So something survives of Ybor City, and some of the old residents have taken a lot of pains to keep the memory of Ybor City alive.
As you have done.
The University of South Florida, in their library, they have the Ybor City Collection. It's a huge collection of memorabilia and books and maps and photographs and everything you want to see about what it was like when this town was really thriving. Mm-hmm. So it's being kept alive that way.
Yes.
Yeah, but today it's a different animal.
But it occurs to me we could certainly use social clubs here in Sonoma County. Wouldn't that be great if we had a place like that to go and congregate and sing and dance and be entertained?
And speak your language.
Yes,
you could speak
language.
Your own language. At the Italian club, they spoke Italian.
Ah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Spanish language. I am infatuated with the Spanish language because it's so beautiful. Have you thought about doing a translation of your book into Spanish?
Actually, I've been approached about it by a friend of mine who's Puerto Rican, but he does a lot of translations, and I've considered it because there is a market, I think, you know, in Latin America for something like this. Mm-hmm. You know, an immigrant community is an immigrant community.
Yes.
It could be Korean.
Yes.
It doesn't make any difference, you know. You're in a new country.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're speaking a new language.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know? And, you know, language determines so much of our life.
Yes.
You know, it determines how we feel.
Absolutely.
You know, there are things I can say in Spanish that I can't say in English.
That's right. Is there an element of autobiography in your book?
Absolutely.
I thought so, but I thought it best to ask.
You know, it's not a memoir.
No.
Because I'm a fiction writer, and I really, you know, need to invent certain things.
Certainly.
You know, and so, but it's based on memories of mine from growing up in that community and what that was like. And as a young boy, you know, who was, you know, a little bit confused about his sexual identity, you know, and exploring. And all those things, you know, are sort of autobiographical, but you know, I had to put them in a context where the reader would enjoy. And for me, fiction works best.
Yes, yes. And your poetry, of course.
The poetry also.
Yes, yes. Have you always written poetry?
Yes. I just told someone else that I've been writing. My first poem I wrote, I was 5 years old. And I think it was influenced largely by my mother. My mother was a poet and a feminist and a labor organizer and many things ahead of her time. She didn't wear makeup. You know, she was that kind of a person and a socialist. All right, that's what I grew up with. But she wrote poems and stories in both languages. She was educated in English, so she could write in English and she could write in Spanish. And many years after her death, I got an envelope from my sister with a lot of these stories in them that my mother had written in both languages. And they're wonderful. They're fiction, of course, but they're just great. Oh. They're just great. And the poetry, because she collected poems of famous poets, and she was. So that, I think that's where I got my poetry from,
It's a calling.
Yes.
Yes, which you inherited from. What a wonderful story that is. Yeah. And so you grew up in a bilingual household.
Absolutely. My father never learned English.
Hmm.
He never had to.
Yes.
All his coworkers spoke Spanish. And when he went to the Cuban club to play cards, they all spoke Spanish. So he didn't need English. Mm-hmm. So he became a citizen.
Yes.
Yeah. But he never learned English. So at home, it was bilingual. I didn't speak English until I started school.
in your book, Cigar City Stories, do you have a favorite story?
Well, you know, it changes.
It's like saying, do you have a favorite child? I know. It's a very unfair question, right?
It changes. But I have to say, really, that my favorite story is the streetcar story.
Oh, the streetcar story.
You know, and that happens to be the most popular story with everyone because it's kind of, you know, outlandish,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
And that is also based on a real experience. You know, my mother was an activist.
Was that you and your mother on the streetcar?
It's based on that, you know, but she did not hijack the streetcar, okay?
Oh.
She didn't do that. But I remember I didn't like going downtown with her on the streetcar because she would always sit in the back.
Yes. But that's a wonderful method of telling the story, to take the story and then kind of amplify it into what might have happened. And you almost go into magical realism, which is an aspect of writing that I admire so much. And we don't know. It's seamless. We, as readers, have no idea how much of that really happened and how much of it, the development of the story.
Yes. Where does the truth leave off?
Right.
You know,
right. Well,
and,
yes.
And the fiction began.
Or where did the facts leave off?
Yeah, and all these stories are based on events that happened that I know about. But I had to invent people to do those things, and I had to invent situations that were interesting, that would keep the reader going and reading and wanting to know more about it. Yeah.
The story of the duel, did that really happen?
The duel.
The duel.
Yes. Yes.
It did. Oh, yes. My goodness.
In fact, you know, I did a lot of research, and there's a lot of material available on Ybor City.
Yes.
If you Google Ybor City, you get a lot of material, and Amazon has a lot of books. There are a lot very academic books about, and they both, two books had the same story in it about this duel that took place between these two men,
right?
And they were dueling because they disagreed about which novel the lector was going to be reading. Right. So I thought, what a wonderful situation. So I invented these people, you know, and it included adultery and, you know,
That's right.
Many other things in there, you know, and childbirth. And,
Yes.
You know, that's life.
And the guys who had the duel, wasn't one of them Spanish?
One was Spanish.
The other Cuban.
The other one was Mexican.
Mexican. Oh, that is interesting.
That's true.
Yes, because there was that tension between the Spanish from Spain and the people born in Mexico.
Yeah, the colonials.
Colonials, right.
Yeah.
And that probably persists to this day, people who can trace their heritage right back to Spain.
Absolutely. You know, the Spanish had a club in Ybor City that was for Spanish people or people who had Spanish blood only.
Oh, my God. Goodness. That's cutting it pretty fine. And, and then the people who spoke Spanish but were not of that same heritage had their own club.
Right, they had their own club.
Or they probably had a lot more fun.
And with the Cuban club was a very big club, and the Italian club was a very big club, you know.
Mm-hmm, right.
And the black Cuban cigar makers who came to this country to work at that time were not the same as the Afro-American Cubans that lived in Florida and were segregated. So they lived together with white people in Ybor City for a while until the city annexed them and changed that. But they started their own club.
Yes, but that would be a complicated situation on that streetcar.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to sort them out by color.
Oh, yeah. Because, well, you know, some of the color was not the big difference there. You know, the Cuban workers that were black were mostly educated and intellectual.
Mm-hmm. And I love the stories about you as a boy. I mean, I assume that you were the boy in the stories. And your paper route and your carefree life and your friends, and as well as your troubles. I mean, being picked on by the bully. I like that, the way that story came out.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of that is pretty much based on the truth. Okay?
Yes. Yes.
But again, you know, I had to dress it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think about growing up today, growing up in Ybor City, and I really had an idyllic life.
Mm-hmm.
We were very poor.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in a government housing project.
Mm-hmm.
And my father got laid off early on from the cigar factory, so he took any job he could take. You know, my mother did ironing at home and took care of children. You know, that we were very, very poor, but I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. And the name of the story about that time is, forgive my pronunciation, El Paraíso? Is that
paradise? El Paraíso was the nickname of a very big cigar factory.
Oh, I see.
And they called it El Paraíso because it had paradise trees planted on the outside. And very lush, you know. So when these Cubans arrived from Cuba and saw that, they nicknamed the place El Paraíso.
This is paradise.
And everybody knew what that meant. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the factories had nicknames.
Yes. And almost all the people I know who can describe their childhood as paradise grew up in what we would call a disadvantaged situation because they found their happiness, those who did find their happiness, as you did, in the home, which was impoverished but rich with love. It always fascinates me how that so many stories.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually grateful that, you know, that I was born in poverty and poor. And throughout my life, you know, I've done better, you know, and I've met, you know, I've had owned property and paid taxes like everybody else, you know. But now in the sunset of my life, I'm 75 years old.
Are you really?
Yeah. I'm poor again.
Yes, in money, perhaps. But, you know, those of us who are somewhat advanced in years have a tremendous advantage as writers.
I am so grateful for my memories. You know, they keep me alive. And because since I'm writing about them, and maybe I can mention my next book.
Oh, that was my next question. Yes, please.
I'm writing today, you know, and I got up this morning and did a little bit. And I find the mornings are pretty good for writing because I can still tap into my unconscious at that point. But anyway, I'm not writing about Ybor City. I have many more stories about Ybor City.
Yes, of course.
But I decided that I would move on and I would write about my experience in the military as a gay man.
Oh, my goodness.
And
good for you.
And this was in the 50s.
Oh.
And you know what? I don't regret it. I had a wonderful time in the Navy. And being gay then in the military is the same as today. Don't ask, don't tell. Don't make any waves. Don't tell anybody, you know. Behave yourself. Be discreet.
Yes.
And it was okay. And it was okay to be gay.
Yes.
It was okay. So I really had a wonderful time. You know, I spent a year on Malta. And Sicily, and then I came back when I went to Key West for a year. So I really did, and I love fishing, so I really had a good time. Oh, yeah.
I want to read that next book. Will you come back when it's published and we'll talk about that book?
I sure will.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I have so enjoyed visiting with you this morning. This is Rosemary Manchester, and I've been speaking with Emilio Gonzalez Llanes, what a beautiful name, I'm so envious of that, about his most recent book, Cigar City Stories, Tales of Old Ybor City. And thanks for coming in, and I look forward to talking with you about your next book.
Thank you for having me, Young. Ybor Dreaming. I drift down palm-lined avenues, past backyards ripe with avocados, papayas, and guavas. I savor a cognac and a cafe solo with cigar makers who roll the finest Havanas in the world. I see electric streetcars swoosh down La Sétima to Palmetto Beach and Ballast Point. I order a pressed sandwich, thin slices of Spanish ham, roast pork and cheese on Cuban bread at the Silver Dollar Cafe. I hear fishermen hawk their catch to housewives in shotgun houses with small porches where workers sit in the evening and sing Cuban boleros and Argentine tangos. I awake to the aroma of coffee roasting at La Naviera, bread baking at Alessi's brick oven, and devil crabs steaming at Miranda's. I hear the blast of ship whistles at the Ybor docks, unloading bananas and sea turtles. I dance to the Cuban rhythms of bongos, timbales, and congas, six trumpets, and a bank of saxophones at the Cuban club. Mambos, rumbas, and cha-chas excite my blood. I cruise down 7th Avenue in pressed khakis to meet the right girl, treat her to a hot Cuban sandwich at Cuervo's, a pastel de piña at Las Novedades, or a mango sherbet at Los Helados. I see my parents, uncles, and cousins lose their jobs to cigar-making machines installed after the war. Families move away, children flee town and never come back. I awake to the thunder of bulldozers storming across the landscape to make room for an interstate. Only brick factories and social clubs remain in a sea of empty lots dotted with fruit trees. I mourn those years of neglect, decay, boarded up storefronts, and crime-infested streets, but Ybor City survives and comes back as a tattooed tart, luring rowdies to drink and raise hell in dark bars that serve singles, bikers, gays, and blacks. I watch semi-nude dancers gyrate to disco music in front of Goyo's murals. I see a gay bathhouse on the same block where I played hopscotch and jump rope. A 20-screen multiplex eclipses El Centro Español, where we danced to the orchestras of Pérez Prado and Tito Fuentes. I return to my dream and stand on the corner of 15th Street and 7th Avenue and see you, radiant and alive again. I hear hot salsa rhythms pouring from wrought iron balconies, trolleys screeching at the turn, and the shuffle of chaveta knives trimming tender tobacco leaves. I smell the spicy aroma of Spanish bean soup and see waiters carrying 2-gallon pots of steaming coffee to the cigar makers in the galleries where lectors stand on platforms and read Cervantes and Tolstoy to the workers. Ybor of my dreams, I miss you.
You've been listening to Emilio Gonzalez Yanez. Let's take a short break, and when we return, Professor Emerita in Women and Gender Studies at UC Davis, Judith Newton, joins us to talk about her memoir, Tasting Home, Coming of Age in the Kitchen. It's a novel idea.
Pasta, it's my favorite thing to eat. Any way you serve it to me, I will think that it's a treat. Boil the water, cook it in a pot, and sauce it in a pan. Then dump it out onto my plate, and I'll eat all I can. Fettuccine, spaghetti, mandacotti, ravioli, tortellini. pasta on a plate or bowl or even in a cup, any time or place or any way, and I will eat it up. Fettuccine, spaghetti, manicotti, ravioli, tortellini, cannelloni, rigatoni, bucatini, baked lasagna and baked ziti, pasta penne and linguine, farfalle, fusilli, macaroni and cheese.
Judith Newton is the author and co-editor of 5 works of nonfiction on feminist criticism, women's history, and men's movements, and now brings us her memoir, Tasting Home, Coming of Age in the Kitchen, which has received an Independent Publisher Book Award. Her memoir, which includes recipes, by the way, is the story of one woman's emotional education, including the love story of her marriage to a gay man. She shows us how cooking can lead to personal healing and social change. Here's Judith Newton in conversation with Rosemary Manchester.
Judith, first of all, let me say that I'm attracted to the book by its cover with the brilliant Frida Kahlo reproduction on the cover.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm very fond of it too.
That really worked.
Yeah. And the Bank of Mexico was very kind in giving me permission to use it.
Excellent. The combination of scholarship, work in academia, and work in the kitchen really came together for me. And it was a wonderful way to guide me through the story that you're telling of your life and your career. And the inclusion of the recipes was a wonderful idea. How did that come about?
Well, I had decided to write a food memoir because I had an epiphany in my kitchen when I had moved from one house to another and thought I had to prune my collection. And instead of pruning it, started missing a cookbook that I had gotten rid of during a previous change of place. I realized that the cookbooks were like a record of my life, but more than that, they'd been agents of my salvation from a difficult childhood, and they had allowed me to create new forms of home. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was going to write a food memoir. And I wanted to, share with my readers by writing about cooking and dining with others, the kind of emotion work that it had performed in my life, the way it had sustained me. I wanted to do more than that. I wanted to put in recipes as a way of giving readers something more, more permanent way of creating wonderful moments in their own lives. I wanted them to feel the way I feel when I pick up these women's magazines in the grocery store, which I'm very fond of, and they're full of women giving each other advice and sharing recipes, and they form a community. And I wanted readers to have that kind of experience with the book, so that's why I put them in.
You know, people will have to have 2 copies, one in the library and one in the kitchen.
One in the kitchen, yes. Right.
Or carry it back and forth and get food stains on it.
Yeah. Right. And also, I thought the recipes gave a better sense of what different cooking experiences had been like. I mean,
yes.
Julia Child's, you know, recipes are 3 or 4 pages. My mother's cooking was 3x5 card, one side.
Right.
So that was a kind of grounding in what it was like to actually cook from different sources.
And you started out in Compton, California, in Southern California. And one of the first recipes that you give is graduation cake. I was impressed with your interpretation of yourself in high school as earnest, diligent, and smart. That just about covers it. And I was interested, you were valedictorian, and yet you really hadn't considered college.
Well, it was the 1950s. My parents hadn't gone to college. Usually, young women from lower middle class families were not going to college. Most of the women that I went to school with didn't go to college. And even after I'd gotten a scholarship from Stanford, which I barely knew anything about, and it was a full ride, my aunt said, "A girl who can sew like you? Why would you want to go to college?" So that it was the time for that kind of attitude toward women if you were lower middle class, as I was.
Yes. And then your high school counselor was the one who suggested that you make application.
Yes, thank goodness.
Oh, thank goodness. And then your English teacher said to you, oh, it's wonderful you're going to Stanford. And you said, I'm not sure I want to leave my boyfriend.
Right. And she said, you can't give up Stanford for a boyfriend. And she was right.
You had some really
but that
good
was
advice.
Part of the 50s, too, because right. What you did was to get married. And most of the young women I knew did get married right out of high school.
Yes.
So I was just going the way that, you know, young women did go.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness someone snatched you out of the current and set you on the path.
I'll always be thankful to her.
Oh, yes. And then the recipe for graduation cake. After that, you say when you got to Stanford, you left oleo and sugar behind.
Yes.
was classic. And at Stanford, you spent a lot of time in the library reading.
I did. It was quite a leap from Compton to Stanford. Yeah. And I was very anxious to do well. So I spent a lot of time in the library and didn't eat lunch. I take these leftover rolls that I had from breakfast, which were actually leftover rolls from the night before, and then I'd have them for lunch. Sometimes I'd have an apple for dinner, and I wouldn't go home until the evening. So that was my life.
And the readers will be happy to know that the recipe for your garlicky cheese toast is in the book.
Yeah, that's an improved recipe.
that was before Julia Child's, of course, which comes along later. But one of your expressions I like, you said, books fed my hunger.
Yes, they did feed my hunger.
From there, you went to Berkeley. And at this point, Julia Child takes over your cooking.
Yes.
What a jump.
It was a big leap because, well, my mother was rather a distant person, and that her cooking and baking were the one kind of reliable form of nurturing that I did receive. But she wasn't interested in teaching me how to cook. I think she wanted to keep that expertise to herself. So, and she didn't measure. You know, she was one of these cooks that could just put things together. It would have been hard to teach me even if she'd been invested in it. So I didn't learn to cook. And after I passed my MA exam in the English department at Berkeley and decided to go on for the PhD because I kind of fell into one stage of a career after another because there wasn't a lot of guidance in the 60s either if you were a young woman. I decided to give a dinner party, and I had bought Julia Child's book because, I don't know, I'd been eating French food in the Mediterranean Cafe in Berkeley, and I thought that was very chic. And so I bought it, and I was going to do this dinner for two very serious graduate students. And I had never read a recipe longer than a 3x5 card. And suddenly I was doing, I think it was four dishes, several pages each.
Yes.
Your
readers will really enjoy your telling the story of putting that meal together. It was, you know, we've all been in a place where we're doing something that's beyond our capabilities at the moment. It's, I think, a fairly universal feeling.
It was wildly optimistic to do this. And I think it was a real reflection of the 60s because we were wildly optimistic about a lot of things. And so I always see that as a kind of 60s book.
Yeah.
But it also gave measurements, unlike my mother. I mean, very exact about measurements, very exact about instructions. And so instead of being kind of lost in the kitchen, I was being led hand by hand through these really elaborate recipes.
Yes.
And that's where I learned to cook. I learned to cook from mastering the art of French cooking.
And it was a triumph.
It was a triumph.
Yes.
And I really fit. And my graduate student friend, the woman, said after her first bite, oh, Judy, this is gourmet. And I really thought, okay, this is my moment of coming into adulthood, that I had learned to cook on my own. I was still working in my mother's tradition because, I mean, I wasn't aware of this, but I was still thinking that adulthood was somehow linked with producing a decent meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I had done something very different from her, and I had, it was a way of establishing an identity. It was still linked to her, but separate and independent.
Well, we've moved pretty quickly from graduation cake to garlicky toast to Judy, this is gourmet.
Yes.
But there is so much to talk about your career that I really haven't done justice to these early chapters. And I want to tell the readers how much they are going to enjoy this story of Judith moving up in the world in terms of not only knowledge, but skill. You encountered, even while you were looking for your first position, your first interview, they asked you if you intended to get married.
Yes.
And, you know, and I want to say, like Dave Barry says, this really happened. I mean, young women today think maybe we made this up about being quizzed about our intentions, our matrimonial intentions, when we were starting on a career.
And the interesting thing is that I made nothing of it because I didn't have a feminist consciousness about anything. Mm-hmm. And it actually began in graduate school when I was interviewing, I was going to interview for jobs and I was talking to my graduate advisor and I said, oh, did you know I'm getting married? And he said, oh, and then he paused and he said, if you're getting married, he said, I think it would be better not to apply for a job. Why don't you stay home and write novels? I said, well, I didn't want to write novels. I want a job, but I didn't. I couldn't quite make sense of that. And then when I was interviewed by Penn, and they didn't get back to me, and I had some other offers, and I called and asked them, well, you know, what is the committee thinking? Then they said, well, here's what we're asking: are you going to have children? And I didn't know what to make of that, so I just answered with a joke, and I said, well, you know, I could come there and marry one of your assistant professors. So what's the difference? And they hired me. But it took me a few years from that interview to understand really what this was all about, that that women were living inside a system that systematically discriminated against them. But it took a consciousness-raising group to bring me to that understanding. Yeah. And from then on, the world looked very different.
Yeah. Judith, the story that you tell about in your Ivy League experience, Professor R and Professor X, would you tell that story for our listeners? Yes.
Well, as I say, I had no feminist consciousness despite these curious questions. And the English department at the time, and I'm sure it's very different now, was a very cold place. Professor X, I call him, which is from Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. He's the professor who's documenting the inferiority of women. Professor X, who was the chair, was a very brusque and kind of cold personality. And he didn't treat the young men well either. We all were suffering from this chilly climate. We weren't allowed to go to the faculty meetings, even though that's where everything was decided because we weren't tenured yet. But Professor R, who is a woman, came up for tenure when I was there. I think it was the second year. And she was an accomplished Shakespearean scholar. And the faculty voted to give her tenure overwhelmingly. I think it was 13-3 or something like that. But unbeknownst to everyone until a little later, the chair had written against her getting tenure. And then there were a lot of protests because she was a very wonderful teacher and, you know, her scholarship was impeccable and she'd had this large vote. They convened a committee. And the committee went along with the chair, and I'm sure this was a hand-picked committee, and the university denied her tenure. And it was clear to me and everyone that this had something to do with her being a woman. And the young faculty, who didn't have tenure, wrote a letter supporting her in her tenure case. And that was in the winter, I guess. And the following fall, when we came up to be judged and okayed for going on for a couple more years, we were told that we would never come up for tenure, that was it. We might have two more years, but we weren't going to get tenure. And a lot of young people left the university, you know, shortly after, for one reason or another. And I myself ended up resigning because I thought, if this is academic life, I'm not interested in being part of it. So I resigned and I put a copy of the letter denouncing the sexism and the inhumanity of the department and the elitism in the box of every one of my colleagues, which caused a mild stir, and I did resign. So that was a baptism into understanding how universities and other institutions worked when it came to promoting women.
And lest people think that this book is entirely about the gender wars in academia, one of the things that kept me reading was the voice. I mean, your voice in the book is so lively. And then the characters. I mean, you met people, you lived with interesting people, you had love affairs, you traveled. I mean, you have such an adventuresome life.
Well, I mean, the overall, I think, major theme is the kind of emotion work that cooking for and dining with others did in my life. So that was very healing personally when I became capable of cooking myself. And it allowed me to create various kinds, recreate, or maybe create for the first time, various homes that made me feel comforted and secure and happy. And that was largely through cooking. My first one was with my first husband, who told me before we married he thought he might be gay, but it was 1966, and I thought, well, you'd get some therapy, and that would be that. And that turned out to actually to be a very good relationship and a very long-lasting one, because even after we divorced, we lived together as roommates until his death, even though I remarried.
It's a lovely story about him.
I do like that
I
story.
I love that love story, yes.
Yeah, I do like yes. that. And, I mean, you love between any two people changes, and so we just changed the way that we loved each other. And then we lived in a commune with my second husband, and there too, cooking was the and eating dinner together was the ritual that kept us together. And then with my daughter in various places, we cooked together in a way that my mother and I never did. And so the episode at Davis when I'm helping to form this cross-race coalition between the Women's and Ethnic Studies programs was also related to food, because one of the things I did was to give these large buffets as a way of bringing different people together, giving them a shared pleasure, drawing them into civil conversation with each other and kind of forming a common bond with one another. So the way that cooking does a kind of emotion work goes all the way through the book and through the experiences I had at Davis.
Yes.
And I learned early on that, too, when I read James Baldwin in 1963.
Yes, yes, you
when
mentioned
I joined
that.
The civil rights movement.
Yes.
That sensuousness, what he called sensuality, really, was important to an activist life. That if you had joy in life, something that kept you optimistic and hopeful and pleasured you, you had a kind of energy for not just your personal life or your work, but also for your political life. And it was the same thing with a political community. If you had a source of joy together, that meant you could bond with one another. And that really helped when we then decided we'd work together and always meet with the administration in a group instead of letting them pick us off one by one.
Mm-hmm.
So the academic part is informed by the cooking and dining and the emotional work that went into that.
Works every time.
It did.
Feed them well, sit around the table
well.
And talk.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. The arc of your story is so easy to follow in the book. And then I was looking for common threads that stayed throughout the whole book. And, of course, your love of learning comes through, your love of teaching, your skill in the kitchen, And then the wonderful birth of your daughter.
Yeah.
You thought it was getting time that if you were going to have a child, you should make that happen. And you did.
Yeah, that was, I mean, then, and that was a piece of history, too, because mm-hmm. a lot of women I knew in their 40s, or they were approaching 40, were feminist, and they had put off having a family because they were invested in their career. And then when 40 hit, it was suddenly like, oh, are we going to pass this up? And a lot of my lesbian friends and lesbian students were on their second child. And I thought, well, you know, we all did. Oh, they're going to have a – because there had been a criticism of the traditional family. But if lesbians were going to have children, we thought, oh, well, maybe we're going to do that too. And a lot of women I knew at 40 were adopting or reconciling with their husbands. I tried to persuade my – well, he agreed, actually, but it didn't work out, my first husband to have a child with me. And, at 43, 44, I did finally have a child. Best thing I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a kind of shared experience with other women as well.
For the reader, it's lovely when that comes into the book. It's like, oh, and she had that too.
It's, yes. In a way, it's a book about what do you do if you haven't had adequate parenting and you need
yes.
to grow up and you need to find sources of feeling at home in the world.
Yes.
And I found that one of the ways that really worked for me was to be motherly.
Mm-hmm.
It was to mother my daughter. It was to mother my program, and because I was head of women's studies,
mm-hmm.
it was to be motherly in a way to my community, mm-hmm. and I got mothering back from them.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, finally, that was the key. It was to turn outward and mother others, and in doing that, you remother yourself, and you can find your sense of home in the world.
It's interesting how that works.
It is.
Yeah, and I was impressed as I was reading the book, how you made it your business to find your own happiness.
Yes.
You weren't looking for somebody to come along and carry you away to happiness. You were looking for ways to make yourself happy. I wish more people did that.
Well, yes. I mean, I guess that came from childhood because I was pretty much on my own in childhood. Mm-hmm. And so if I was going to be happy, I wasn't that happy, but mm-hmm. if I was going to be happy, I did have to find it myself, and I found it mainly in books in school.
Yes.
That continued forever.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You enjoyed teaching, didn't you?
I did enjoy it.
Oh,
it's a form of parenting, too.
Yeah.
Or it's a form of loving. It's a form of giving, yeah. because you can't be that successful in the classroom unless your heart is in it,
right.
unless you really want to help your students. And I loved my initial field, but I loved all my fields. I was very interested in, Victorian novels, and
yes.
I felt I really had something to say about mm-hmm. them, and I really wanted to share that, and I thought it would be good for them. So it was a form of, it's a form of loving.
Mm-hmm. I see the audience for your book as people who are interested in education, people who like biographies, and people who love to cook. I mean, those are just one of some of the first things that occur to me. But there's a universality in your story that is compelling, and you tell it with a light touch. There is no whining in this book. There are things
Thank
that
you.
Might be whined about, but there is no whining. You find your way through, and you find it with joy and enthusiasm and imagination. And it's, I think it's a marvelous book. I enjoyed so much reading it. And I encourage other people to get your hands on a copy of Tasting Home, Coming of Age in the Kitchen by Judith Newton.
Well, I think what you just said is something I want people to take from the book. In some ways, I mean, it's a book about It's a book that encourages people to give parties. Yeah. It's a book that says no matter what suffering you might have endured in your life, and there was suffering, life can still be joyfully led. It can be intense. It can be joyful. It can be shared with other people. So that is what I want people to take away from it, that sense of being able to find something that keeps you going. And for me, that was food and cooking it for other people and eating it with other people, sharing it.
It's a remarkable memoir. I read a lot of memoirs, and I really loved following you through the improbabilities of your life, from Death Valley to Stanford to Berkeley to the on into academia, and all the things that you've accomplished. Well, thanks so much for coming in. I've really enjoyed talking with you about Tasting Home, Coming of Age in the Kitchen by Judith Newton.
Well, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed this conversation, too. Okay. I love the questions.
Judith Newton and Rosemary Manchester. We'll be back again next month in our new time slot, Sundays at 4, with more conversations with writers about their work. You can listen to us anytime at krcb.org or subscribe to our podcasts and listen through iTunes. I'm Suzanne Lang. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. It's a novel idea. Thanks for listening.